baby. She shook her head, still crying, her shoulders shaking. Heidi, please. No response. She was scaring me, so I reached out, taking Isby from her arms. As soon as I did, she curled into herself, pulling her knees to her chest and turned her face away from me. I looked at her, then at Isby. I had no idea what to do. And while I knew I should probably call my dad or even my mom, I instead walked to the kitchen and dialed the one number I thought might put me in contact with someone who could help. Gasgrow, Wanda speaking. In my mind, I could see the cashier that was always there at the same time of night, with her dangling earrings and blonde hair. I cleared my throat. Hi, Wanda. I jiggled Isby, who was sputtering a bit. This is Auden. I come in there a lot around this time of night for coffee. I'm trying to find Eli's stock. It's kind of an emergency. I mean, not really, but he's about 20 or so, dark hair, drives a black... Hello? At the sound of Eli's voice, I felt some small part of me relax. Hi, it's me. I paused, then clarified. Auden. I had a feeling, he replied. I'm not sure who else would actually call me at the Gasgrow. Yeah, I said, glancing at Heidi, who was harder than ever to see now in the dark of the living room, curled into the couch. Sorry about that. I just kind of have a situation here, and I'm not sure what to do. A situation? He repeated. What's going on? I stepped into the foyer, putting Isby over my shoulder, and told him. As I did, faintly, distantly, I could hear Heidi still sobbing. Sit tight, he said when I was done. I know just what to do. 20 minutes later, there was a knock at the door. When I walked over and opened it, there was Eli, carrying 4 cups of grow roast and a pack of cupcakes. Coffee? I said. This is your solution? No, he replied. This is. And he stepped aside, revealing a small, middle-aged woman with short, dark hair. She had familiar olive skin and green eyes, and was wearing a sensible cardigan and slacks, a purse strapped across her, and spotless white tennis shoes. Mom, this is Auden. Auden, my mom. Karen Stock. Hi, I said. Thank you for coming. I don't know what to do. She smiled at me, then leaned closer, looking down at Isby, who was now starting to fuss. How old's the baby? 6 weeks. And where's Mom? In the living room, I said, stepping back from the door. She's just crying. She won't even talk to me. Mrs. Stock came inside. Then she looked at Eli and said, Take the baby upstairs and swaddle her. I'll be up shortly. He nodded and then looked at me. Should I? I asked. I mean, she'll be just fine, she said. Just trust me. And the weird thing was, I did. Even as I stood there, watching this stranger walk past me into the living room. She put her purse down on the kitchen table, then moved over to Heidi, sitting down beside her. When she began to speak, I couldn't make out a word she was saying. But Heidi was listening. It was clear in the way that, after a moment, she let Mrs. Stock pull her into her arms, patting her on the back as she allowed herself to be the one soothed. Finally. By the time we got to the pink room, Isby was all out fussing, working up to one of her fits. Eli stepped inside, flicking on the light, then said, Got a blanket? A blanket? He nodded. In the dresser, third drawer maybe? I watched, jiggling Isby a bit as he walked over, rummaging around for a minute, before pulling out a pink one with brown dots. He glanced at it, then shut the drawer. "We need a bed," he said. "Something flat. Where's your room?" "Next door," I said. "But I don't..." He was already walking next door, leaving me no choice but to follow. Once there, he spread the blanket out on the bed sideways, then folded down the top corner. "Okay," he said, holding out his hands. "Give her here." I shot him a doubtful look. "What are you doing?" "Didn't you hear my mom?" he asked. "You're supposed to trust me." "She said to trust her," I pointed out. "You don't trust me?" I looked at him, then at the blanket, then at Isby, who was all out squawking, and had a flash of him leading me to the center of the floor at Tally Ho, not even a full day ago. I handed her over. Isby was wailing, her face getting redder and redder as he carefully laid her down, her head just on the edge of the folded blanket. Then, as she writhed around, he put her left arm to her side and pulled the bottom tip of the blanket up and across her, then tucked the bottom corner over her shoulder. With each step, Isby wailed louder. "Eli," I said, raising my voice to be heard, "you're making it worse." He didn't hear me, moving to the last corner, which he pulled tight across her waist and around her. Isby was all out screaming now. "Eli," I said again, practically yelling, as he pulled the last corner tight and started to tuck it into one of the other folds. "Stop it! She's not..." And then, suddenly, it was silent. It happened so abruptly and completely that for a moment I was sure Isby had died. But when I looked at her, and she was just lying there, all wrapped up, like a tiny burrito, blinking at us. "Crying," I finished. Eli reached down, picking her up, and handed her back to me. "How did you do that?" "It's not me," he said as I eased myself carefully onto the bed. Isby opened her mouth, but only yawned, then settled against me. "It's the swaddle. It's like magic. My mom swears by it." "It's amazing," I said. "How does she know all this?" "She was a maternity ward nurse," he replied. "Just retired last year. Plus, my brother and sister have four kids between them. Add in all of us, and she's had a lot of practice." There was a light tap on the door, and then Mrs. Stock stuck her head in. "Heidi's going to take a little rest," she said. "Let's go downstairs." Eli and I followed her down the hall, past Heidi's room, where I could see a small sliver of light under the closed door. Just as I started down the steps, it went out. In the kitchen, Mrs. Stock went to the sink, where she washed her hands, then dried them on a paper towel. "All right," she said, turning to me with a smile. "Give me that baby." I did, and she took her, easing down into a chair, and I watched as she brushed her fingers over Isby's forehead. "This is a good swaddle," she said. "Eli's a pro," I told her. "Just well trained," he said. And we both watched as she rocked Isby slowly, patting her back with her hand. "Thank you for coming," I said finally. "Heidi's been having kind of a hard time, but when I got home and found her like that, I didn't know what to do." "She's a new mom," Mrs. Stock said, still looking down at Isby. "She's exhausted." "My dad tried to convince her to get help, but she wouldn't do it." Mrs. Stock adjusted the blanket a bit. "When I had Stephen, my oldest, my mother came and lived with me for a month. I couldn't have done it without her." "Heidi's mom died a couple of years ago." She mentioned that. She said. And I thought of Heidi's face, crumpled as she curled into Mrs. Stock, there in the dark. I wondered what else she'd said. The truth is, being a mom is the hardest job in the world, but she'll be fine. She just needs some rest. We all considered this as Isby, way ahead of us all, closed her eyes. Mrs. Stock looked at Eli. "You," she said, "would be well advised to go to bed as well. Don't you work in the morning?" "Yeah," he said, "but..." "Then get on home," she replied. "Leave me your keys. You can pick up the truck tomorrow." "So I'm walking?" he asked. She gave him a flat look. "Eli Joseph, it's 4 blocks. You'll survive." Eli grumbled, but he was smiling as he dropped his keys onto the table. "Thanks, Mom," he said. She offered him her cheek, and he kissed it, then turned toward the door. I followed him out onto the porch. "So," I said, glancing back into the kitchen, where Mrs. Stock was still rocking Isby. "Guess it's an early night." "Guess so," he said. "Mom doesn't exactly know about my nocturnal habits." "She wouldn't approve?" He shook his head. "Nope. In her mind, no good can come after midnight." I looked up at him, then smiled. "Well, I have to say, your mom's amazing. But I don't agree with that." "She is amazing," he said. "And I don't either." Then he leaned down, kissing me, and I slid my arms around his neck, pulling him a little closer. I could have stood there all night, good or no good. But then he was pulling back, glancing over my head at the kitchen. "I better go." I nodded. "See you tomorrow." He smiled, then stepped off the porch and started down the front walk. I waved one last time, then watched him until he disappeared into the dark, just past the streetlight's glow. Up in my room, I leaned out my window and looked down the road in the direction he'd gone. It was a long, flat road, and as it got later, there were only a few lights visible, here and there. I picked one that I figured was about 4 blocks down. Then I watched it like a star, burning bright, all the way until morning. Chapter 11. It was a week later, and my brother was scheduled to arrive around 5 p.m. At 4:30, my phone rang.
"I'm only calling," my mother said, "to warn you."
She and I had not spoken since her own visit to Colby had ended so disastrously, a fact that seemed to now be behind us, if this contact was any indication. Still, I was cautious as I said, "Warn me about what?" There was a pause as she took a sip of what I assumed was her early glass of wine. Then she said,
"Valora."
The qualifier pretty much said it all, but I bit anyway. "What? You don't like her?"
"Auden,"
she said. I could almost hear her shudder.
"She's horrible. Horrible. I don't know what your brother got into over there, but clearly it's given him brain damage. This girl, she's...
Rarely had my mother ever been at a loss for words. I was actually starting to get a little worried.
"A scientist," she finished. "One of those cold, methodical types, all about hypotheses and control groups, and her ego in assuming that everyone else is interested in it as well. Unparalleled. Last night she bored us for an entire dinner talking about myelinated cells."
"About what?"
"Exactly," she said. "There's no heart to this girl, no soul. She's only a few years older than your brother, but acts like a Puritan schoolmarm. I have no doubt she'll take everything unique about Hollis and suck it out of him. It's horrifying. I looked out my open door, down the hall, where I could see Heidi sweeping out my father's office, which had been converted into a second guest room. Thisbe was parked in her bouncy seat, watching her. Since that bad night, things had been a little better. In the end, Mrs. Stock had stayed over, tending to Isby, and when I came down late the following morning, she had just left. I found Heidi in the kitchen, with the swaddled baby in her arms, looking more rested than she had in weeks. "That woman," she said in lieu of a hello, "is a miracle worker." "Yeah?" She nodded. "She was here for 3 hours this morning, and I already know about 100% more than I did yesterday. Did you realize that swaddling helps a baby feel secure and fussless?" "I did not," I said, "but it appears to be true." "And she helped me raise the baby's mattress, which will reduce her gas, and said I should buy a swing to help her sleep. Plus, she knew exactly what to do about my nipples being so sore." I winced. "Heidi, please." "Sorry, sorry." She waved her free hand at me. "But really, I'm so grateful to you for bringing her here. I mean, she's even offered to come by again if I need help. But I don't know. Last night was just so strange. I don't know what happened. I was just so tired." "It's fine," I said, as always wanting to avoid a big emotional moment. "I'm just glad you feel better." "I do," she said, looking down at Isby again. "I really do." Since then, she had seemed to be in better spirits, and Isby was sleeping a bit more, which was good for everyone. Still, Mrs. Stock had dropped by a couple more times, although I always seemed to miss her. When she'd visited, though, I could always tell. Heidi just seemed happier. Unlike my mother, who was still going on about Laura and how she was sucking out my brother's joie de vivre, one myelinated cell at a time. "I don't know," I said to her now. "He seems to really like her." "Your brother likes everyone. That's always been his fatal flaw." Another dark sigh. "You'll see when you meet her, Auden. She's just..." I glanced back out my window, just in time to see a silver Honda pulling into the driveway. "Here," I finished for her. "I better go."
"God help you," she muttered. "Call me later."
I told her I would, then closed my phone and walked out into the hallway just as my dad was yelling up to Heidi that Hollis had arrived. "Ready to go meet your brother?" she said to Thisbe, bending down to unbuckle her from her seat. Together we walked to the top of the stairs, just as my dad opened the front door. I could see Hollis getting out of the car, and even though it had been more than 2 years that he'd been gone, he looked pretty much the same, a little skinnier, his hair somewhat shaggier. When Laura stepped out of the passenger side, she too looked awfully familiar, although at first I couldn't figure out why. Then Heidi gasped. "Oh my God," she said. "Laura looks just like your mother." She was right. Same long dark hair, same dark clothes, same pale, pale skin. Laura was a little shorter and curvier, but still, the resemblance was striking. The closer they got, the more it freaked me out.
"There he is," my dad said, pulling Hollis in for a hug as he stepped over the threshold. "The world traveler returns." "Look at you, proud papa. Where's that baby girl?" Hollis said, grinning.
"Right here," Heidi said, starting down the stairs. I made myself follow her, even as Laura came in the door, taking off her sunglasses and folding them.
Her eyes were dark, too.
This is Thisbe.
Hollis immediately reached for the baby, lifting her up high over his head. She looked down at him, as if trying to make up her mind whether to start crying or not.
Oh, boy, he said. You're gonna be trouble, I can just tell.
My dad and Heidi laughed, but I kept my eyes on Laura, who was standing just off to the side, still holding her sunglasses, watching this scene with a somewhat clinical expression. After a moment of Hollis making googly faces at the baby, she very quietly, but pointedly, cleared her throat.
Oh, babe, sorry.
Hollis handed Thisbe off to my dad, then reached an arm over Laura's shoulder, pulling her in closer to everyone else.
Everyone, this is my fiancé, Laura.
Fiancé?
My dad said.
You didn't mention that in your phone call. When did you...
Laura smiled, showing no teeth.
We didn't, she said. Hollis is just...
Confident,
my brother finished for her. And ready, even if she isn't. I keep telling Hollis that marriage is serious, Laura said. Her voice was very even and clear, like she was used to having the room's attention. You can't just jump into it like an airplane. Dad and Heidi and I just stood there, not sure what to make of this, but Hollis just laughed.
That's my girl. She'll break my impulsive streak yet.
Oh, don't do that,
my dad said to Laura, clapping Hollis on the shoulder again.
We love that about this guy.
Impulsiveness can be charming, she agreed. But deliberation can have an appeal as well. My dad raised his eyebrows.
Actually, he said, his tone a bit sharper than before,
You must be exhausted from your trip, Heidi said, reaching to take Thisbe from my father. Let's go and have a cold drink. We've got lemonade, beer, wine.
She turned, starting for the kitchen, and Hollis and my dad immediately fell in behind her, leaving me with Laura. I watched as she examined her sunglasses, then took a corner of her black shirt, slowly rubbing a spot on one lens clean, before again folding them shut. Then she looked up at me, as if surprised to find me still standing there.
It's really nice to meet you, I said, for lack of anything better.
Hollis seems...
he's very happy.
She nodded.
He's a very happy person, she said, although from her tone I couldn't tell if she thought this was an asset or not.
Babe, my brother yelled, get in here. You've got to see this view.
Laura gave me another tight smile, then walked into the living room. I waited a beat or two, then followed her, stopping in the kitchen where my dad and Heidi were huddled together by the sink, pouring lemonade into glasses.
Her first time meeting us, Heidi was saying. She's probably just nervous.
Nervous? You call that nervous? My dad replied.
Heidi said something else, but I didn't hear her, having turned my attention to my brother and Laura. They were standing in front of the open glass doors, the ocean a wide, clear blue in front of them. Hollis had his arm around her shoulders, gesturing with one hand as he said something about the horizon. But even from the back, I could tell Laura was not particularly impressed. It was something about the posture, the way her head was slightly tilted to the side. Sure, she was a stranger, but I'd seen it before.
So you don't like her?
I looked over at Eli.
I didn't say that. You didn't have to.
He pulled a container of milk off the shelf, sticking it in the cart. It was 1:30 a.m., and we were at Park Mart, doing a little shopping. As it was a Monday night, we had the place pretty much to ourselves, and the quiet was just what I'd needed, having earlier endured a 2-hour family dinner that had basically developed into an argument between my dad and Laura about capital punishment. This followed their spirited discussion about university funding, liberal arts versus sciences, over cocktails, which had come after a protracted debate about environmental policy during lunch. For me, it was like watching an adaptation of the last couple of years of my parents' marriage, just with someone else playing the role of my mom. "It's just," I said to Eli, pushing the cart forward to follow him out of the grocery section and into sporting goods. "She's really different from all the other girls Hollis has dated."
"And what were they like?"
A blur of gorgeous, friendly faces appeared in my mind. "Nice," I finally said. "Sweet. More like Hollis." Eli stopped to check out a camping stove, then moved on. "He didn't want to marry any of the others, though, right?" I considered this as we passed a collection of catcher's mitts. Not for more than a few minutes.
"But this girl, he says, is the one."
We were coming up on the bike section now, several lined up in a row, from kids' sizes to adults. He pulled a mid-size bike off the rack, bouncing it on its front tire.
"So it seems to me it doesn't matter what you or your mom or dad think. Relationships don't always make sense, especially from the outside."
"But this is Hollis," I pointed out. "He's never been serious about anything." He climbed onto the bike, then rose up on the pedals, moving slowly forward.
"Well," he said, "maybe he just found the right person. People change."
He was riding around me and the cart, and as I watched him, I thought of my mother saying these same two words with a "don't" between them, with equal conviction. "You know," I said finally, "everyone thinks you never ride anymore."
"I don't."
I rolled my eyes, since he was passing me again as he said this.
"Then how come I'm watching you do it right now?" "I don't know," he said. "What do you think?"
The truth was I wasn't sure. But I wanted to keep believing people could change. And it was certainly easier to do so when you were in the midst of it. The way I imagined I was as I stood there, aware of a slight breeze each time he passed, like a wave, the feeling of motion. I'd been at Clementine's for over an hour, catching up on paperwork, when I got the distinct feeling someone was watching me. And that someone was Maggie.
"Hi," she said when I looked up to find her standing in the half-open doorway. She had on a white eyelet sundress and orange flip-flops, her hair pulled back at her neck, and was holding a pricing gun.
"Got a minute?"
I nodded, and she glanced back out at the store before taking a step inside, then clearing a stack of catalogs off a nearby chair and sitting down. She didn't say anything, and neither did I. All I could hear was a pop song, playing from the sales floor. Something about roller coasters and sweet, tangy kisses.
"So look," she began. "About you and Eli." This wasn't a question, or even a statement. It was a fragment. And this was my justification for not responding. How can there even be a whole answer to a part of something? "I know you guys have been hanging out all night. Like, every night," she continued. "And it's not exactly my business, but..."
"How?" I said. She blinked at me.
"How is it not my business? How do you know?"
"I just do."
What, you're all-knowing and all-seeing now? I asked. Who are you, Big Brother?
This is a small town, Auden. In many ways, minuscule. Word gets around.
She sighed, looking down at the gun.
Look, the thing is, I've known Eli a long time. I don't want to see him get hurt.
I'd honestly had no idea what she was getting at. None.
But when I heard this, I felt like a fool for not having seen it coming.
You think I'm going to hurt Eli? She shrugged.
I don't know. After what happened with Jake.
That was totally different, I said.
See, but I don't know that.
She sat back, folding her legs.
All I have to go on is what I've seen, and while the thing with Jake pissed me off because I was jealous, it was also somewhat karmic. He had it coming. Eli doesn't.
We're just... I trailed off, not sure how much I wanted to explain this.
We're friends.
Maybe so. She looked down at the gun again, turning it in her lap.
But we both know you're the reason he showed up at the party the other night. I heard you call him.
I raised my eyebrows.
You are like Big Brother.
I was in the bathroom. The walls are so thin there. I sometimes can't even pee if anyone's in the kitchen.
She waved her hand.
Anyway, then there's the bike thing and the fact that you threw beans at him and he didn't completely go ballistic.
It was just a food fight.
You don't understand, though, she said. Eli hasn't done anything since Abe died. No parties, no hanging out, hardly even any conversation. Definitely no food fights. He's been under this cloud, and then suddenly you show up and all that changes, which is great.
But, I said, because there is always a but.
But, she continued, if you are just jerking his chain and playing around, he might not just bounce back like Jake did. There's more at stake here, and I just wasn't sure you knew that, so I wanted to tell you, because that's what friends do.
I considered this as the music outside changed to something slower, more dreamy sounding.
Well, I said, I guess he's lucky he has you.
As a friend, I mean.
I wasn't talking about Eli.
I looked up at her.
What?
We're friends, she said, moving her hand back and forth between us. And friends are honest with each other, even if the truth hurts, right? I would have agreed with this. But my own truth was that I really didn't know. All of this was new to me, so instead I said,
You don't have to worry. Nobody's getting hurt. We're hanging out. Nothing more.
She nodded slowly.
Okay, then. That's all I need to know.
There was a beep from the sales floor, signaling a customer entering. Maggie got to her feet. Then stuck her head out the door.
Hi, she called out. I'll be right with you.
No worries, a voice I recognized replied. Just tell Auden to get her butt out here.
Maggie turned to look at me. My brother, I explained, pushing my chair back.
You have a brother?
Come and see for yourself.
When we got out to the floor, Hollis was standing by a box of half-off swimsuits, examining a purple thong bikini.
Not your size, I said as I approached. Or color, either.
Too bad, he replied. I think it would look boss on me, don't you?
I think you should stick to trunks, I told him.
Actually, Maggie piped up, in Europe, men often wear a more bikini style. Every summer we have at least one group of German tourists who show up in them.
No way, Hollis told her. Over there, you just go to the nude beach. No suit needed, period.
This is Maggie, I said to him. Maggie, my brother, Hollis.
You went to a nude beach? She asked him.
Seriously?
Sure, why not? You know what they say, when in Rome. Or Spain.
He tossed the thong back into the box.
So, Aud, you up for a very late lunch or super early dinner? Dad says there's a place with great onion rings I should try.
The Last Chance, Maggie told him. End of the boardwalk on the left. I recommend the tuna melt.
Hollis sighed. I love a tuna melt. That you can't get in Spain, even if you are naked.
I glanced back at the office. I actually have a lot of work to do.
Oh, come on. You haven't seen me in 2 years.
Hollis shook his head at Maggie.
My sister. She got all the drive in this family, obviously.
Go, Maggie said to me. You can just stay later tonight or something.
Listen to Maggie, Hollis said.
He said her name casually, like they'd known each other for years.
Come on, let's go bond.
Out on the boardwalk, it was that golden time of afternoon, past the heat of the day, but before it began to cool off for evening. Hollis and I fell in behind a group of women with strollers, their wheels clacking across the boards beneath us.
So where's Laura? I asked him. She doesn't like onion rings?
Loves them,
he replied, sliding on his sunglasses.
But she has work to do. She's applying for some grant for the spring and has some essays to write for it.
Wow, I said. She sounds like the driven one.
Pa, no kidding. She's unstoppable.
He tipped his head back, looking up as a row of pelicans flew overhead toward the water. And I watched with him for a moment. Then I said, "She seems really nice, Hollis."
"She is." He smiled at me. She's not like any of the other girls I've dated, huh?
I wasn't sure how to answer this, but he was asking, so I said, not really. No.
You should have heard Mom, he said, laughing. For years she's on me for only dating vapid, mindless drones. Her words, of course.
Of course.
And now I show up with someone smart and amazing, and she totally freaks out. You should have seen her at dinner when Laura was talking about her work. So jealous, she was almost sputtering.
Wow, I thought. Out loud, I said,
"Jealous? You think?" Oh, come on, Aud. You know Mom's used to being the smartest woman in the room. It's her thing.
He reached up, adjusting his sunglasses.
She kept pulling me aside, telling me I was making a mistake, that I was too serious about Laura too quickly. Like I'm going to take relationship advice from her, with that grad student lurking outside, sleeping in his car like some kind of stalker.
What? I said. He glanced at me.
Oh, you know, she was sleeping with some grad student. He got serious about her and actually wanted something from her, so she cut him loose, and now he's hanging around, licking his wounds.
I had a flash of the guy in the dark-framed glasses, sitting out by the pool with his book. I didn't even know his name.
I felt so bad for the guy, Hollis was saying now. Although God knows he should have seen it coming. It's not like she hasn't done it before.
It took me a minute to absorb all this, so I focused on the bike shop, which was coming up ahead. I could see Wallace and Adam on the bench outside, sharing a bag of potato chips.
You think she does that a lot?
Oh, God, yes. Since the divorce, anyway.
he slid his hands in his pockets, then glanced at me.
I mean, you knew that, right? You had to.
Sure, I said quickly. Absolutely. He watched my face for a moment. Then he said,
Not that I can say anything, though, considering I used to be just like her.
Again, I was speechless. What do you do when you finally hear everything you've always thought said aloud? This time, though, I was saved from having to reply, as Adam spotted us.
Hey, Auden, come settle an argument.
Hollis glanced over at him and Wallace.
Friends of yours?
Yeah, I said as Adam waved us over. Hollis looked surprised, which I tried not to take personally.
Come on.
When we got over to them, I introduced my brother as Adam hopped off the bench, landing in front of us.
Okay, he said, holding up his hands. We're finally on the brink of a new name for the shop.
Which is to say, Wallace piped in from behind him, his mouth full of chips.
Though we've narrowed the list of possibilities to 10.
10? I said.
But only 5 are any good, Adam added.
So we're taking an informal poll to see who likes which ones. Hollis, always game, looked up at the bare awning.
What's it called now?
The bike shop,
Wallace told him. Hollis raised his eyebrows.
It's temporary.
For the last 3 years, Adam said.
So, okay. The list in no particular order is as follows. Overdrive Bikes, The Chain Gang, Colby Cycles.
I was distracted temporarily as Eli came out of the shop, pushing a small pink bike with training wheels. He had a helmet in his free hand, and a couple with a little girl in tow were right behind him.
The crankshaft and pedal to the metal bikes, Adam finished. What do you think?
Hollis thought for a second.
The chain gang or the crankshaft, he said. Overdrive is boring. Colby Cycles too corporate.
That's what I said, Wallace said, pointing at him.
And pedal to the metal, I don't even know what to say about that.
Adam sighed.
Everyone hates it. The only reason it's still on the list is that it's my favorite. Auden, what do you think?
I was still watching Eli, though, as he bent over the pink bike, adjusting one of the pedals. The little girl for whom it was clearly intended, a redhead, wearing blue shorts and a t-shirt with a giraffe on it, stood holding her mom's hand, looking apprehensive.
Like I said, he was saying, this is a really good starter bike.
She wants to learn, her mom was saying, running a hand over her daughter's head. But she's kind of nervous.
Nothing to be nervous about.
Eli stood up, then looked at the girl.
The training wheels will keep you up until you get the hang of it, and then one day, you just won't need them anymore.
How long does it usually take, though?
The father, who had on a baseball cap and leather sandals, asked.
What's the norm?
Different for everyone, Eli told him. When she's ready, she'll know.
What do you say, honey? The woman asked. Want to try it out?
The girl nodded slowly, then stepped forward. I watched as Eli held out his hand, helping her onto the bike, then strapped the helmet on her head. She reached for the handlebars, carefully stretching her fingers over them.
All right, sweetie, her dad said. Just pedal like you do on your trike.
The girl put her feet down, tentatively pushing on the pedals, and moved about a half an inch forward. She glanced back at her parents, who smiled at her, then tried again. After another incremental budge, I watched as Eli put his hand on the back of the bike, nudging it forward just slightly. She was still pedaling and didn't even notice. But when she really began to move, she looked back at him,
grinning.
Auden?
I turned my head to see Adam looking at me, his face expectant. I said, I don't really like any of them that much, to be honest.
His face fell. Not even the crankshaft?
I shook my head.
Not really.
I told you they all sucked, Wallace said.
He liked two of them, Adam shot back.
Not that much, Hollis said. Adam sighed, flopping back down on the bench, and I waved goodbye as Hollis and I started walking again toward the last chance. After a few steps, though, I looked back at that little girl again. After that initial push, she'd gotten going for real, and now had passed two storefronts and was almost at Clementine's. Her mom was trailing behind her, close but not too close, as she slowly made her way, all on her own. The last chance was empty for once, and we got a booth right by the window without having to wait. As Hollis perused the menu, I looked out onto the boardwalk, watching the people walk by.
So, Aud, he said after a moment, I gotta say, I'm really happy you did this.
I looked over at him.
Did what?
This, he said, gesturing around the restaurant.
Coming here for the summer, hanging out, making friends. I was worried you'd spend this summer like all the others.
Like all the others? I repeated.
You know, he picked up his water, taking a sip. Hanging out in the house with Mom, refilling wine glasses at our little superior get-togethers, studying for classes that haven't even started yet.
I felt myself stiffen. I never refilled wine glasses.
You get the idea.
He smiled at me, clearly unaware that he might have offended me, or at least hurt my feelings.
My point is, you're different here.
Hollis, I've only been here for a month.
A lot can happen in a month, he replied. Shoot, in 2 weeks I met my future wife, changed my entire life's trajectory, and bought my first tie.
You bought a tie? I asked, because honestly, this was almost the most shocking part.
Yep, he laughed.
Seriously, though, seeing you here with your friends, it just really makes me happy. Hollis, I said. Now I was uncomfortable again, but for different reasons. My family was a lot of things, and changing daily, or so it seemed, but sentimental was not one of them.
Come on.
I'm serious. He looked down at his menu again, then up at me.
Look, Aud, I know the divorce was hard for you. And living with Mom afterward had to be even harder. She's not exactly kid-friendly.
I wasn't a kid, I told him. I was 16.
You're always a kid around your parents, he replied. Unless they're acting like children, then you don't get the chance.
You know what I'm saying? I realized suddenly that I did. Just about the same time that it hit me why my brother had stayed gone for so long, careful to keep an ocean and a telephone line between us and him. It was the reverse of most families. To be a kid, you had to leave home. It was returning that made you grow up, once and for all. Just as I thought this, Adam and Wallace whizzed by on a pair of bikes, zigzagging through the pedestrians. Hollis said,
Speaking of which, it's not too late.
Too late for what?
To learn to ride a bike.
He nodded back at the shop.
I bet your friends could teach you.
I can ride a bike, I said.
Yeah? When did you learn?
I just looked at him. When I was six, I said. In the driveway. He thought for a moment.
You sure about that?
Of course I am.
Because all I remember, he said, is you getting a bike, falling off it right away, and then it sitting in the garage and slowly rusting until Dad gave it away.
That, I said, is not what happened. I rode all over the driveway.
Did you?
He squinted, thinking hard.
Well, you're probably right. God knows I've killed a few brain cells in the last few years.
This was the truth. Between the two of us, there was no question whose memory was more reliable. And wouldn't I know my own history better than anyone else? Still, even as we ordered, I couldn't stop thinking about what he'd said. He was going on about Laura and Europe, but I was only half listening as I thought back to that day in the driveway. It was all so clear. Climbing on, pushing down on the pedals, rolling forward, it had to be true. Didn't it? Chapter 12.
So the word on the street, my mother said in her formal, cool way, is that you've changed.
I took my toothbrush out of my mouth, already wary.
Changed?
These days she always called around 5, when I was waking up and she was ending her workday. I wanted to believe it was because she missed me, or had realized how important our connection really was to her. But I knew that really, she just needed someone to vent to about Hollis, who was back under her roof, still madly in love with Laura and completely on her nerves.
For the better, if that's what you're asking,
she said now, although her tone suggested she wasn't entirely convinced.
I believe the exact word your brother used was blossomed.
I looked at myself in the mirror. My hair was uncombed, I had toothpaste on my lips, and was still wearing the scoop-necked tee I'd had on last night at the bowling alley, which reeked of smoke. Not exactly flowery.
Well, I said, that's nice, I guess. He was particularly impressed, she said, with your newfound social life. Apparently you've got scads of friends and a serious boyfriend as well.
The fact that this last part was phrased as a question pretty much said everything about how she felt about it personally.
I don't have a boyfriend, I told her. Just a boy you spend your nights with.
A statement this time. I looked at myself in the mirror again. Yep, I told her. That's about right. Among all the other sudden changes in my brother, he was now an early riser. Hollis, who'd always slept past noon, as well as a jogger. He and Laura ran every day at sunrise, then came home to do yoga stretches and meditate. Although apparently he wasn't that immersed in his ohms and namastes. When he heard me coming in the morning after their arrival, he immediately came to investigate. Auden Penelope West, he said, wagging a finger at me as I carefully shut the door behind me. Look at you, doing the walk of shame.
I'm not ashamed, I replied, although I did kind of wish he'd keep it down. And who is this young man dropping you off? He asked, pulling aside a blind to peer out at Eli, who was backing his truck out of the driveway. Shouldn't he have to show himself? Get my approval before taking you out courting?
I just looked at him. From the living room, I could hear Laura chanting.
My little sister, he said, shaking his head. Staying out all night with a boy. Seems like just yesterday you were playing Barbies and skipping rope.
Hollis, please, I said. Mom considered Barbies weapons of chauvinism, and nobody's skipped rope since 1950.
I just can't believe, he said, ignoring this. You're growing up so fast. Next, you'll be married and bouncing a baby on your knee.
I ignored this, walking past him to the stairs, but it didn't stop him. Not then, and not the mornings that followed, when he always managed to be waiting for me, opening the door as I came up the front walk. One day, he was actually sitting on the porch when we pulled up, necessitating both an introduction and a conversation with Eli.
Nice guy, he'd said, when I'd finally wrangled him away. What's with the scars on his arm, though?
Car accident, I told him.
Really? What happened?
I don't really know, actually.
He shot me a doubtful look as he pulled the front door open for me. Seems kind of weird, considering how much time you two spend together.
I shrugged. Not really. It just hasn't come up. I could tell he didn't believe me. Not that I cared. I'd long ago stopped trying to explain my relationship with Eli to anyone, including myself. It wasn't any one thing, but many strung together. Long nights, trips to Park Mart and Builder's Supply, pie with Clyde, bowling in the early morning, and my quest. We didn't talk about our scars, the ones you could see and the ones you couldn't. Instead, I was having all the fun and frivolousness I was due in one summer, night by night. Now, my mother took another sip of her wine as I left the bathroom, heading back down the hall. Thisbe's door was slightly ajar, and I could hear her waves, steady and crashing, over and over again.
Well, she said, frankly, I'm glad to hear you're not getting involved with someone. The last thing you need before you head off to DeFreeze is some boy begging you to stay with him. A smart woman knows a fling is always best.
There had been a time when I liked my mother to think we were similar. Even craved it. But hearing this, I felt a weird twinge. Something not settling right. What I was doing with Eli wasn't like her and her graduate student, plural. So, I said, shaking this off, how's Hollis doing? She sighed, loud and long.
He's insane, completely insane. I came home yesterday, and do you know what he was doing?
I don't.
Wearing a tie.
She gave this a minute to sink in, then added,
she had him interviewing for a job at a bank. Your brother, who this time last year was living in a tent on the side of a mountain in Germany.
It was just too easy to get my mom off my back these days. One mention of Hollis and she was off and running.
A bank? I said. What's he gonna be, a teller or something? Oh, I don't know, she said irritably. I didn't even ask. I was so horrified. He did volunteer, however, that Laura thinks employment might help him to be more responsible and prepared for their future together. Like that's a good thing. I don't even think this is a relationship. It's so dysfunctional. I don't know what to call it.
Call it chicken salad.
What?
Too late. I realized this had slipped out without me even realizing it. Nothing, I told her. I heard footsteps and looked down the hall just in time to see Heidi and my dad coming upstairs. From the looks of it, they too were having a pretty intense conversation. My dad was throwing his arms around, his annoyed face on, while she just shook her head. I eased my door shut, switching my phone to my other ear.
Ridiculous,
my mom was saying now. 2 years of culture and travel, and for what? To sit and process deposits all day long? It's heartbreaking. She really sounded sad. Still, I couldn't help but say, Mom, most people Hollis's age have jobs, you know, especially if they aren't in school. I didn't raise either of you to be like most people, she replied. Don't you know that by now? I had a flash of myself the night before, standing at the Park Mart with Eli, in the toy section. He'd stopped by a big display of rubber sport balls, pulling one out and bouncing it on the floor. Oh, yeah, he said. Hear that? The bouncing noise? It's more, he told me, than a bouncing noise. That is the noise of imminent pain. I looked at the ball, still moving up and down under his open palm. Pain? In dodgeball, he explained, or kickball, if you were playing the way we did. Wait, I said, holding up my hand. I have played dodgeball and kickball. Really? I nodded. I'm impressed. And they aren't even indoor sports. Oh, it was, actually. At school, in the gym. He raised his eyebrows. What? It's the same game. Actually, it's not, he said. Come on. Seriously, there's school rules and neighborhood rules. The two are very different. Says who? Anybody who's played both, he said, tossing the ball back. Trust me. Now my mother took another sip of her wine. Oh, I almost forgot, she said. A packet has arrived for you, from DeFries. Orientation information, I'm assuming. Would you like for me to open it? Sure, I said. Thanks. There was the sound of paper tearing, then crinkling. She sighed. As I suspected, meal plan info, updated transcript requests, a roommate questionnaire, which is due at the end of the week, apparently. Really? Oh, for God's sake, she groaned. It's like a compatibility test. What activities do you enjoy? Would you say you're a workaholic or more carefree with your studies? What is this, higher education or internet dating? Just stick it in the mail to me, I said. I'll get it back as fast as I can. And if you're late, you'll end up with some carefree, activity-loving roommate. We're better off filling it out now, she muttered. Oh, wait a moment. There's a second page here where you can request alternate living arrangements. Meaning what? She didn't say anything for a moment, busy reading. Then, there are certain floors and dorms you can request where everyone has a specific focus, such as foreign languages or sports. Let me just... Ah, perfect. I heard a pen scritching. What's perfect? The Pembleton program, she replied. I just signed you up for it. What? She cleared her throat, then read aloud. Housed in a dorm removed from the main campus, the Pembleton program offers academically strong students an environment dedicated solely to their studies, with single rooms, on-site research materials, and close access to both libraries. Members of Pembleton are free to focus on their work without the distractions of regular dorm life. Which means... No roommate, no parties, no nonsense. It's just what you want. I said. I don't know. It sounds kind of restrictive, don't you think? Not at all, she replied. You won't have to deal with drunk frat boys and hormonal gossiping girls. It's ideal. Now, I'll just sign your name here and we can... Don't,
I said quickly. I could feel her surprise. Could see her on the other end of the phone, pen in hand, eyebrows raised. I mean, I'm not really sure I want to live there. Silence. Then, Auden, I don't think you understand how distracting it can be to live in a dorm environment. There are people who come to college purely for the social life. Do you really want to be stuck in a room with someone like that? No, I said, but I don't want to spend every single second studying either. Oh. Her voice was flat. I suppose this is part of your blossoming, then? Suddenly, school isn't important anymore. Just boys and girlfriends and clothes? Of course not, but... A sigh, loud, filling my ear. I should have known spending the summer with Heidi would do this to you, she said. I spend 18 years teaching you about the importance of taking yourself seriously, and in a matter of weeks you're wearing pink bikinis and totally boy crazy. Mom, I said, my voice rising, this isn't about Heidi. No, she shot back. It's about your sudden lack of drive and focus. How could you let yourself get this way? Hearing this, I had a flash of my dad, attributing all I'd done to the name he'd chosen for me. All the good was their doing, the bad, mine. I bit my lip. I haven't changed, I told her. This is just me. Silence. And I knew, within it, that the fact this might be true was worse than any frat boy or pink bikini ever could be. Well, I'll just stick this in the mail. She drew in a breath, stiff, formal. You make your own decision. I swallowed. Okay. For a moment, neither of us said anything. And I wondered what could possibly follow this. How we could come back from such an impasse, this huge expanse stretching between us. There were a million different ways, I was sure, but my mom surprised me by not choosing any of them. Instead, she hung up, leaving me with a simple click, the last word, and no idea where to go from here. Apparently, conflict was contagious, or at least in the air. When I left my room about 20 minutes later to head to work, Thisbe's waves had stopped, and another steady noise was coming from her room, the sound of bickering. Of course you deserve a night out, my father was saying. I'm just not sure tonight is the right one, is all I'm saying. Why not? Heidi asked. I could hear Thisbe making noises in the background. I'll be back for the 9 o'clock feeding. The baby's just had a nap. 9 o'clock? It's only 5:30 right now. Robert, we're having cocktails and dinner. Where? Istanbul? My father said. There's no way that will take 3.5 hours. There was a prolonged silence. I didn't have to peek inside to imagine the look on Heidi's face. Finally, my dad said, Honey, I want you to go have fun, but it's been a long time since I've been alone with a newborn for that long, and I just... She's not a newborn. She's your daughter. Thisbe sputtered, as if agreeing with this. You've raised 2 lovely children. You can do this. Now go ahead and take her so I can go finish getting ready. I heard my dad start to say something, but then the door was opening and I darted out of sight. Not fast enough, though. Auden, he called out. Could you? No, she can't, Heidi said over her shoulder. Then she nudged me forward. Keep walking. He's fine. When we got to the stairs, I turned to look at her. Instead of the Heidi I'd gotten used to seeing, clad in sweats and a ponytail, dark circles perennially under her eyes, this was a different woman entirely. Her hair was sleek, her makeup done, and she was wearing dark jeans, heels, and a fitted black top, a silver necklace with a key studded with red stones around her neck. This I recognized. We'd just gotten them in at the store the previous week, and they were already selling like hotcakes.
"Wow," I said, "you look great."
"You think?" She glanced down at herself. "It's been so long since I could wear this stuff, I didn't even know if it would fit. I guess stress does burn a lot of calories after all." Down the hall, I could hear Thisbe beginning to fuss. Heidi looked over, then turned on her heel, walking to her bedroom. I followed her to the doorway, leaning against it as she picked up her purse from the bed. "So, I have to say," I said as she rummaged around, finally pulling out a lip gloss, "you sure seem different all of a sudden. And it's not just the clothes." Thisbe was really crying now. Heidi bit her lip, then uncapped the gloss, putting some on. "You're right," she said. I've realized over the last couple of weeks that I needed to take some time for myself. We've talked about it a lot, actually."
"You and Dad?"
"Me and Karen."
"Really?" I said.
She nodded, dropping the gloss back in the bag. "Ever since the baby was born, I've been so hesitant to ask your dad for any help. I'm so used to doing everything myself, and it wasn't like he was really offering much."
"Or any," I said.
"But Karen kept pointing out that you and your brother were just fine. And he was your dad as well. She said it takes two to make a baby, and at least that many to raise one as well."
"Usually more."
She smiled. "She made me promise her that I'd set up that girls' night my friends have been wanting forever. I was dragging my feet, though, until Laura came." When she said pretty much the same thing, I figured they had to be on to something. I watched as she checked her hair in the mirror, adjusting a piece in front.
"I didn't realize you and Laura talked when she was here."
"Oh, we didn't at first," she replied, picking up her purse. "To be honest, she kind of scared the crap out of me. Not exactly the warmest person, you know?"
I nodded. "No kidding."
"But then the night before they left, I was up late with Thisbe, and she came down for a glass of water. At first, she was just sitting there, watching us, and eventually I asked her if she wanted to hold her. She said yes, so I handed her over, and then we just started talking. There's a lot more to her than it seems at first glance."
"You should tell my mother that," I said. "She hates her."
"Of course she does," she said. "It's because they're so similar. They both have that whole cold, bitchy, wary of other women thing going on. It's like two magnets repelling each other." I thought of my mother just moments earlier on the phone, her voice so sharp and dismissive. If I wasn't like her, she didn't care to know who I was. "So, you think my mom has more to her than that as well?"
"Of course she does. She has to."
"Because..." She looked at me. "Because she raised you. And Hollis. And she was in love with your father for a very long time. Truly cold bitches don't do that."
"What do they do?"
"They end up alone." I raised my eyebrows.
"You sound awfully sure about that."
"I am," she said. "Because I was one."
"You?" I said.
"No way." She smiled. Someday I'll tell you all about it. But now I've got to run and kiss my daughter and then try to leave without having a breakdown, okay? I nodded and was still standing there, trying to process this, as she started into the hallway. When she passed me, she paused, bending down to quickly kiss my forehead before moving on, the smell of her perfume lingering behind her. Maybe it was to prove her point, or just instinct. Either way, it was surprising, but not as much as the fact that I didn't really mind it. Not at all. Later that night, I was walking to the gas grow after work when I heard a car coming up behind me. A moment later, a newspaper landed with a slap at my feet. I looked at it, then at Eli, who was now pulling up beside me.
So, you have a paper route now?
Technically, he replied as I picked up the paper, noticing the stacks of others piled up in the back of the truck. My friend Roger has a paper route. But he also has the flu, so I'm helping him out. Plus, I thought it might apply to your quest.
Delivering papers?
Sure. He stopped the car, gesturing for me to open the passenger door. When I did, he said, "It's a rite of passage. My first job was delivering the Colby coupon clipper on my bike."
"I've had jobs," I told him.
"Yeah? What were they?" "I worked for a professor in the English department one summer, helping with the bibliography for his book," I said as I slid inside. "Then I worked for my mom's accountant as an office assistant, and all last year I did test prep at Hunsinger." Personally, I'd always thought this was a pretty impressive resume. Eli, however, just gave me a flat look.
"You," he said, hitting the gas, "definitely need a paper route. At least for one night."
And so it was that, after hitting the washroom and Park Mart for a few incidentals, we pulled into a neighborhood just past the pier, driving slowly with a stack of papers between us and a list of subscriber addresses in his hand. It was just after 2 a.m.
1100, Eli said, nodding at a split level off to the right. "That's all you."
I picked up the paper, getting a good grip, then tossed it toward the driveway. It hit the curb, then bounced into a pile of lawn clippings, disappearing entirely.
"Oops," I said.
He pulled to a stop, and I jumped out, retrieving it and throwing it again, this time doing a bit better, hitting the far right of the driveway.
"It's harder than it looks," I told him when I finally got back in the car.
"Most things are," Eli said. Then, of course, he grabbed a paper, launching it at a house across the street in a perfect arc. It landed right on the front stoop, the delivery version of a perfect 10. When I just looked at him, speechless, he shrugged.
"Colby coupon clipper, I told you. 2 years."
"Still," I said. My next shot was a bit better, but too wide. It hit the lawn, and again I had to get out to move it to a safer, less wet spot.
"God, I suck at this."
"It's your second one," he said, before launching another perfect shot at a bungalow with a plastic flamingo in the front yard.
"Still," I said again. I could feel him watching me as I threw another one, concentrating hard.
It hit the steps, good, but then banked into the nearby bushes, not so good. When I came back from retrieving it, some brambles in my hair, my frustration must have been obvious.
"You know," Eli said, tossing another paper and hitting another front stoop. Thwack. "It's okay not to be good at everything."
"This is delivering papers."
"So?"
"So," I said as he did another perfect throw, "Jesus. I'm all right if I suck at, say, quantum physics or Mandarin Chinese. Because those things are hard and take work. He watched, silent, as I missed yet another driveway, by about a mile. When I returned, he said, "And clearly this doesn't." "It's different," I told him. "Look, achievement is my thing, okay? It's what I do. It's all I've ever been good at." "You're good at doing well," he said, clarifying. "I'm good," I said, throwing another paper and doing marginally better, "at learning. Because I never had to involve anyone else in that. It was just me and the subject matter." "Indoors, working away," he added. I shot him a look, but as usual, he didn't seem deterred or bothered in the least. He just handed me another paper, which I launched at the next house. It hit the driveway a bit too much to the left, but he drove on anyway. "Life is full of screw-ups," he said, chucking another paper at a split level before taking the corner. "You're supposed to fail sometimes. It's a required part of the human existence." "I've failed," I told him. "Yeah? At what?" I blanked for a moment, not exactly good for my argument. "I told you," I said. "I was a social failure." He took another turn, tossing a couple more papers as we cruised down a dark street. "You didn't try to be homecoming queen and lose, though." "Well," I said, "I never wanted to be homecoming queen or any of that stuff." "Then you didn't fail. You just opted out. There's a difference." I considered this as we cruised down another street. He wasn't even handing me papers anymore, just throwing them all himself. "What about you, then?" I asked. "What did you fail at?" "The better question," he said, slowing for a stop sign, "is what didn't I fail at?" "Really?" He nodded, then held up a hand and began to count off, finger by finger. "Algebra, football, Lacey McIntyre, skateboarding on a half pipe." "Lacey McIntyre?" "Eighth grade. Spent months working up to ask her to a dance, and she shot me down cold, in full view of the entire lunchroom."
"Ouch."
"Tell me about it." He turned again, going down a narrow street with only a few houses on it. Thwack, thwack. Winning over Belissa's dad, who still hates me, convincing my little brother not to be such a chump, learning to fix my own car.
"Wow, this is a long list.
I told you, I'm very good at being bad at things." I glanced over at him again as we came to another stop sign. "So, you never get discouraged?"
"Of course I do," he said. "Failing sucks, but it's better than the alternative."
"Which is?"
"Not even trying."
Now he did look at me, straight on.
"Life's short, you know."
I'd never met Abe, or even heard much about him, aside from the few things Maggie and Leah had said. But suddenly, in that moment, it was like I could feel him, sitting in the very seat where I was, riding along with us. Maybe he'd been there the whole time. Eli took another turn, and I realized we were in my dad's neighborhood, the surroundings suddenly familiar. His house was quickly approaching, and on my side to boot. It had to be a sign. I reached over, picking up a paper from the stack between us. "Okay," I said. "This one's mine." I drew back my hand, trying to use my elbow for leverage, the way I'd seen him do,
and this time aimed not for the driveway but the porch. It came closer, closer, and at the exact right minute, I let it fly. Watching as it arced high over the lawn before landing with a slap on the windshield of Heidi's Prius. Eli slowed to a stop.
I know it's family, he said, but that demands a do-over.
I slid out of the car again and walked over to grab the paper, tucking it under my arm. Then I crept up as slowly as possible to the porch, trying to be quiet as I bent to slide it onto the perfect center of the mat. Just as I did, though, I heard my dad's voice.
Just my point. I wanted you to have what you wanted, but what about what I want?
I shrank from the door, backing down one step as I glanced at my watch. It was almost 3 a.m., entirely too late for most people to be up, unless something bad was happening.
Are you saying you don't want the baby?
Heidi said. Her voice was higher, shaky.
Because if that's true...
This isn't about the baby.
Then what is it about?
Our lives, he replied, sounding tired. And how they've changed.
You've done this before, Robert. Twice. You knew what it was like to have an infant in the house.
I was a child myself then. I'm older now. It's different. It's... Silence. All I could hear was Eli's car, the engine murmuring behind me.
Not what I expected, my dad finished.
You want the truth. There it is. I wasn't ready for all this. All this. Such a round, all-encompassing term, as wide as the ocean, which I could also hear distantly, the real waves this time. But even with all that vastness, it was impossible to tell what or who it really included. It seemed safest to just assume everything.
This, Heidi said, is your family.
Ready or not, Robert. I had a flash of all those cul-de-sac games I never really played, but knew the rules to nonetheless. You hide. Whoever is it counts down, and then, ready or not, they came looking for you. If they got close, you had no choice but to stay put, hoping not to be found. But if you were, there was no wiggle room. Game over. I could hear my father starting to say something, but I wasn't a child this time, and didn't have to stay and listen. I could leave, disappear into the night, which was vast, too, wide and all-encompassing, with so many places to hide. So I did.
Forgive the mess, Eli said, reaching inside the dark room for a light switch.
Housework is another one of my failings. In truth, his apartment was simply plain. One large room, with a bed on one side, a single wooden chair, and TV on the other. The kitchen was tiny, the counters bare except for a coffee maker, a box of filters beside it. Still, I appreciated his efforts to pretend otherwise, if only because it meant we weren't talking about the fact that I'd pretty much lost it only moments earlier. I thought I'd been fine as I backed away from my dad's house, walking across the already dew-damp grass to the truck. Fine as I slid in, picking up another paper to throw. But then Eli had said, "Hey, you okay?" And the next thing I knew, I wasn't. It's always embarrassing to cry in front of anyone, but bursting into tears in front of Eli was downright humiliating.
Maybe it was the way he just sat there, not saying anything. The only sound, my hiccuping sobs and loud sniffles. Or how, after a moment, he just drove on, throwing papers at houses while I looked out the window and tried to stop. By the time he'd pulled into the dark driveway of a green split-level house a block from the boardwalk, I'd gotten calmed down enough to be racking my brain for some way to play the whole thing off. I was thinking I'd blame sudden-onset PMS, or maybe my devastation at sucking so entirely at paper delivering. Before I could say anything, though, he cut the engine, pushing his door open. "Come on," he said. As he got out, I sat there for a moment, watching as he began to climb a narrow flight of stairs beside the garage. He never looked back to see if I was following him, which was probably why I did. Now, he shut the door behind me, then walked over to the kitchen, dropping his keys on the counter en route to turning on the coffee maker. Only when it began to brew, the smell wafting toward me, did I go to join him. "Have a seat," he said, his back to me as he bent into the fridge, rummaging around for something. "There's a chair." "And only a chair," I said. "What do you do when you have company?" "I don't." He stood up, shutting the fridge. He had a stick of butter in one hand. "I mean, usually." I didn't say anything. Instead, just watching as he pulled a saucepan out of the cabinet, sticking the butter in it before placing it on the stove. "Look," I said as he turned on the burner. "What happened back there?" "It's okay," he said. "We don't have to talk about it." I was quiet for a minute, watching as he melted the butter in the pan, tipping it from side to side. It was just another courtesy that he'd given me this easy out, the chance to move on. And I thought it was a gift I'd take, and gratefully. Until I heard myself say, "Remember how you were asking me what I'd failed at earlier?" He nodded, jiggling the pan over the stove. "Yeah. The social thing, right?" "That," I said. "And keeping my parents together." It wasn't until I said this that I realized it was true. That I hadn't blanked out at this question earlier so much as thought of an answer I couldn't say aloud. At least until I'd overheard my dad and Heidi fighting, and it all came rushing back to me. Those awkward dinners, with the picky little arguments, the unsettled feel of the house as the hours went on and on, closer to my bedtime. The way I learned to stretch the night all around me, staying awake and alert to keep all the things that scared me most at bay. But it hadn't worked. Not then, and not now, either. I blinked, feeling a tear roll down my cheek. 3 years of total stoicism blown in one night. Talk about humiliating. "Hey, Auden." I looked up to see Eli watching me. He'd taken out a box of Rice Krispies at some point, and instead of looking back at him, I focused on the faces of Snap, Crackle, and Pop, all gathered happily around a big cereal bowl. "I'm sorry," I said, because for some reason, even with these cartoon distractions, I still seemed to be crying. I don't even think about this anymore, but then when I went to throw that paper, they were fighting, and it was so..." He put the box down, then came over to the opposite side of the island. He didn't try to reach out for me or touch me. He just stood there, near, as he said, "Who was fighting?" I swallowed. "My dad and Heidi. Things have been pretty bumpy since Izvi came, and tonight I guess things just blew up or something. God, I was still blubbering. My voice was all choked, coming in little gaspy sobs. Eli said, "Just because people fight doesn't mean they're splitting up." "I know that. I mean, my parents used to go at it sometimes. It just kind of cleared the air, you know? It was always better afterward." "I know my dad, though," I said. "I've seen him do this before." "People change." "Or they don't," I replied. Finally, I made myself look at him. Those green eyes, long lashes, his haunted face not as haunted anymore. "Sometimes they don't." He just stood there, looking at me. And I had this flash of us here in this little garage apartment, in the middle of the night. From up above, in a plane passing over, you'd just see one little light in all this dark, with no idea of the lives that were being lived within it, and in the house beside, and beside that one. So much happening in the world, night and day, hour by hour. It was no wonder we were meant to sleep, if only to check out of it for a little while. There was a sudden crackling pop from the stove, and Eli looked over his shoulder. "Whoops," he said, turning back to the saucepan and pulling it off the heat. "One sec, let me just finish these." I wiped my hand beneath my eyes, trying to collect myself. "What are you doing over there anyway?" "Making Rice Krispie treats." This seemed so odd and incongruous, it almost made sense, along with everything else that night. Still, I felt compelled to ask, "Why?" "Because it's what my mom always did when my sisters were crying." He glanced back at me. "I don't know. I told you, I never have company. You were upset, and it just seemed..." He trailed off, and I looked around the room, taking in the plain bed, the one chair, the single light outside the door, glowing yellow and bright all night long. "Perfect," I finished for him. "It's perfect." Of course, nothing is really perfect, but Eli's Rice Krispie treats were pretty close. We ate half a pan while we split the pot of coffee, using the one chair as a table, each of us sitting on the floor on either side of it. "So, let me guess," I said, putting my mug on the floor by my feet. "You're a minimalist." He glanced around the room, then back at me. "You think?" "Eli," I said, "you have one chair." "Yeah, but just because all the furniture at my old place was Abe's." Hearing this, it was all I could do not to start or jump. So jarring was it to hear him say his name after all this time. Instead, I took another sip of my coffee. "Really?" "Yeah." He sat back, picking a bit of sticky crumb off the side of the Rice Krispie pan. The minute he made some prize money riding, he was all about decorating our place, and he bought the stupidest stuff. Huge TV, singing fish. "A singing fish?" "You know, those plastic ones that you hang on the wall, and when you walk by they start singing, like, some Motown song." I just looked at him. "Okay, so you don't know. Consider yourself lucky. Ours was, like, the center of our apartment. He put it right by the door, so it went off constantly, and everyone had to listen to it." I smiled. "Sounds interesting." "That's not the word I'd choose," He shook his head. Plus, he insisted on buying these big papasan chairs, you know, the ones that are circular, filled with squishy cushions. I wanted a plain, normal couch, but no, we had to have these stupid things that everyone was always getting sucked down into. No one could ever get up and out of them on their own. We were always having to pull people out like a freaking rescue mission. Come on. I'm totally serious. It was ridiculous. He sighed. And then there was the whole waterbed thing. He said he'd always wanted one. Even when it leaked and gave him a crazy backache, he would not admit it was a mistake. I must have spilled something, he'd say, or I really pulled a muscle on that last ride. He was hobbling around like an old man, complaining constantly. All night long, all I could hear was him thrashing around, trying to get comfortable. It was like an endless squishing. I laughed, picking up my mug again. So what happened? Did he finally give it up? No, he said. He died. I knew this, of course. But even so, hearing it this way was like a shock to the system all over again. I'm sorry, I said. See, but that's the thing, though. He sat back, shaking his head. Everyone always wants to tell these stories, all the stories. It's all anyone wanted to do at the funeral and after. Oh, remember this thing and this and what about this? But the ending to every story is the same. He dies. That's never going to change. So why even bother? We were both quiet for a moment. I guess, I said finally, that for some people it's how they remember. You know, by telling stories. It keeps the person close. But I don't have that problem, he said quietly, not remembering. I know. You want to talk about failure? He looked up at me, meeting my eyes. Try being the one who was driving, who got to live. Eli, I said. I tried to keep my voice low, even, the way his had been when he'd been reassuring me. It wasn't your fault. It was an accident. He shook his head. Maybe. But the bottom line is I'm here and he's not. And everyone who sees me, his parents, his girlfriend, his friends, they all know that. In all the uncertainty, it's the one thing they know for sure. And it sucks. I'm sure they don't hold it against you, I said. They don't have to. He looked down at his mug, then up at me. The whole do-over thing. That's all I think about since it happened. What if we'd left that party earlier or later? If I'd seen the car coming at us and not stopping a moment sooner. If he'd been driving instead of me. There are a million variables, and if even one was different, maybe everything would be. We were both quiet for a moment. Finally, I said, "You can't think like that, though. You'll make yourself crazy." He gave me a wry smile. "Tell me about it." I started to say something, but then he was getting to his feet, picking up the tray and taking it to the kitchen. Just as he did, I heard a thump from the wall by his bed, followed by another. I stood up, walking closer, and listened again. "That's the McConners," Eli said from the kitchen. "The who?" He came right over, standing behind me. "The McConners. They own this house. Their son's room is right through that wall." "Oh," I said. He usually wakes up once or twice a night, asks for water, you know, the whole thing. Eli sat down on his bed, the springs creaking beneath him.
If it's really quiet, I can hear every word.
I sat down beside him, listening hard. But all I could make out was two voices murmuring, one high, one lower. It was kind of like Heidi's waves, distant white noise.
I used to do that, Eli said. We were both whispering. The whole waking up, wanting water thing, when I was a kid. I remember it.
Not me, I told him. My parents needed their sleep. He shook his head, lying back on the bed, folding his arms over his chest. Through the wall, the negotiations continued, the higher voice rising, urgent, the lower one staying level.
You were always thinking of them, huh?
Pretty much. I stifled a yawn, then looked at my watch. It was 4:30, about when I usually headed home. Through the wall, the voices kept going, and, still listening, I slid down next to Eli, resting my head on his chest. His t-shirt was soft beneath my head, and smelled like the detergent I knew he used at the washroom.
It's late, I said quietly. He should go to sleep.
Not always so easy.
His voice was low, slow, too, and I felt his lips brush the top of my head gently. The light was still on in Eli's kitchen, but it became muted as I closed my eyes, still hearing those murmurings behind me.
Shh, shh, everything's all right.
I was sure I heard a voice say. Or maybe it was the one in my head, my mantra.
Shh, shh.
It's not your fault, I said to Eli, my voice sounding thick to my own ears.
You're not to blame.
Neither are you,
he answered.
Shh, shh, it's all right.
It was so late, late for children, late for anyone. I knew I should get to my feet, go down those stairs and find my way home. But already I could feel something happening. A feeling thick and heavy creeping over me. It had been so long since I'd done this that for a moment a part of me was scared, wanting to fight it off, stay vigilant. But instead, just before it took me, I rolled over, pressing myself closer against him. I felt his hand rise to my head, and then I was gone. When I woke up the next morning, it was 7:30, and Eli was still sleeping. His arm was around my waist, his chest moving slowly up, down, beneath my cheek. I closed my eyes again, trying to drift back, but the sunlight was slanting in overhead, the day already begun. I eased myself away from him, getting to my feet, but then stood watching his face, relaxed and dreaming, for a few moments. I knew I should tell him goodbye, but I didn't want to wake him. Plus, I had no idea what I could say in a note that would possibly convey how grateful I was to him for everything he'd done for me the night before. In the end, I did the closest thing I could. I refilled the coffee maker, put fresh grounds in a new filter, and flipped the switch. It was already brewing as I slipped outside and made my way down his steps to the street. It was one of those gorgeous beach mornings, bright and sunny already, everything enhanced with the benefit of actual nighttime sleep. Walking the 4 blocks or so back home, I was more aware than ever of the salt in the air, the beauty of the rambling roses climbing along someone's fence, even the friendliness I felt toward the bicyclist I passed. An older woman with a long braid, wearing a crazy orange